Flaming the station. Welcome to the station, the Babylon 5 podcast.
And welcome to episode 6 of the station. This is Mitch.
This is Steve.
And the episode this week is Mind War. I do want to, before we get into this, just mention that the TV movie script book is just being released by the Cafe Press and the Joe Store. If you don't have it already, go to b5scripts.com and put in an order today, because as of the end of April, it will no longer be available. This one does have the complete version of the Lost Tales, including 20 pages longer of the main two stories, plus the complete Garibaldi story that was never filmed. It also has 3 pages of detailed notes on what will possibly become the Babylon 5 movie, which is about the telepath war. So I just thought that would fit in with the mind war.
Got a little news coming on.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's real quick with the Lost Tales. Is there no longer going to be any more released to DVD?
There may or may not be. It's all going to depend on whether or not Warner Brothers decides to pay more money. They paid a grand total of, I think it was $3 million for the Lost Tales, with an hour and a half or however long it was. And the sets were cheesy, and it didn't feel like Babylon 5. They did what they could with a microscopic budget, but Joe has said that it looks like what it is, microscopic budget, and if there are going to be more, they're going to have to pay more. So it all depends on Warner's. They every year or so go to Joe and say, hey, why don't we do a movie? And one of the big catches is Joe always insists that if he's going to do it, the cast is going to be involved, and it's going to be the cast from the show, including Claudia. And it's not going to be recasted, including roles like Jakar and Dr. Franklin. They would have to be written out of whatever movies they would be in, because he is absolutely against recasting. And I applaud him for that. They tried to do the Telepath War a couple of years ago, and they wanted someone else because people like Bruce Boxleitner were not big enough names, according to Warner's. Well, sorry, but he and O'Hare and Christian and Furlan and the others are the reason we watch the show. We know them and have watched them for years, so they're the people we want. We don't want recasting, unless it's someone like Drawl, because, you know, history.
Well, you know, Joe learned his lesson about recasting when Julie Caitlin Brown was replaced by Mary Kay Adams.
Well, there are other bits of recasting that happened for one reason or another, including Walter. Recasting just sort of happens sometimes. In the case of that – well, we'll get into that when we get into season two about the recasting with another actress. But let's get back to Mind War.
Yeah, this is a cool episode. This really opens a lot of doors and introduces a lot of really important aspects that will become extremely important later on in the series.
Yep. It was the 10th episode produced and filmed, and it was the 6th episode aired. It was originally intended to have been shown in that 10th slot, but the executives at PTEN decided, hey, we like this. It's a very strong episode. Let's air it in the very next available slot. So it got put into the 6th episode slot. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Walter Koenig. Walter originally was not supposed to be playing Bester. Bester was originally going to be a one-episode mustache-twirling villain. Walter was supposed to have played Knight One in the episode And the Sky Full of Stars. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack and was therefore not available. They recast that. The second choice for that was Patrick McGoohan, who played number 6 in the TV series The Prisoner, and that was the reason for the whole okay from the forehead.
Yeah, that gesture that they always use.
Exactly, yeah. And be seeing you. That was all a tribute to him, and then the third choice was Christopher Neame, who ended up playing Night One.
Did a really good job, too.
Oh, absolutely. He was brilliant in there. But that is the reason that Judson Scott was chosen as Night Two, because he and Walter would have worked together again. They had worked together in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Walter, this was the second role, and this role was written with him in mind once the other part was no longer available. He, as you see, is no longer a mustache-twirling villain. He is a full character. First day on the set, one of the things that he did was have his hand in the fist and not be able to use it. He decided that was part of the character. And he never did use his fist.
Yep.
That was something that continued on. Mind War brings Bester and a psychopath named Miss Kelsey to the station. They are chasing a guy named Jason Ironheart. Jason was one of Talia's instructors back at the academy, and something has happened. We don't know what, but they are chasing him because he is now a threat.
And right from the start, we begin to see the Psi-Corps as a really shady, antagonistic kind of organization. You know, there is instantly a sense that the Psi-Corps, you know, is not to be trusted.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, just in the way that they treat their own. When Bester and his associate, you know, who are both the strongest telepaths that officially exist, the way that they telepathically interrogate Talia really is pretty torturous. And, yeah, you just kind of get this Gestapo vibe off the Psi-Cops, and they're kind of a shady bunch.
And there's something with the Talia Ivanova relationship that comes out of here. After they do that deep mind probe, the one who offers Talia water is Susan. There's no prompting at all. It's just, here's this glass of water.
It was instantaneous, almost instinctive.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was like a reflex.
Right. And she did it to a telepath, the person or the character, the group that she fears most. Mm-hmm. She is seeing that, hey, there's worse out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Talia does eventually find Jason. And Jason, he kind of is from the William Shatner School of Acting. At least in this episode. I've seen him in other stuff and he's fine. But he kind of talks like, I am becoming. And it's like, okay, staccato.
Yeah.
What's the deal with this?
He has such a weird rhythm and cadence.
Absolutely.
To the way that he performs this character. What's that actor's name? You got it? Who is he?
Yeah, William Allen Young.
Okay. What else has he done? Is this his most prominent performance? I haven't seen him anywhere else.
No, he's got a recurring role on CSI as Dwayne McWayne.
Oh, okay.
And for 5 years on a show called Moesha, he played a character called Frank. Just a character thing. I don't know if he was told by the director. Director Bruce Seth Green, he is made of awesome again. he's done some of the best B5 episodes, and he does amazing camera work. Jason Ironheart is just kind of weird. We've got Miss Kelsey, who is stuck up. She is... she never did get out of that mustache-twirling role. She's there. She's saying stuff like, well, when someone else goes down, we have to be stronger. We have to be there to take them down. And Susan asks, well, who watches the Watchmen? And she has nothing to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
There are just so many fun things in here, and I love how often Susan takes her down a peg. And it keeps happening.
No, I'm drawing a blank here. But if I'm not mistaken, isn't this the episode where Ivanova's like, "Geez, another calculated risk. What do you do for fun? Juggle babies over fire pits? Whoops! There goes another calculated risk."
That's the one.
That is classic Ivanova. I love it.
Another thing that I love is what happens with Miss Kelsey. There's no possibility that she could ever be back.
Oh, I know. Yeah, because she is taken right out.
Oh, yeah.
Look at somebody and vaporize them.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
With a casual thought, he has to concentrate every second of every day. If he loses concentration for a microsecond, people go boom.
Yeah, and it's funny. You know, he signed up for this program, you know, when as the plot develops a little bit, Talia comes to Jason because, you know, he's an unstable telekinetic. His powers are growing exponentially and beyond his ability to control them. If he is in a room, he is putting everything around him in danger, because if he does not control his mind, then just by accidentally not being focused, he could destroy everything. He can with his mind, he can take things apart atom by atom, and it's more of an effort not to than it is to do this. So he's in the process of trying to escape to a place where this process can run its full course.
And he can become Q.
And, yeah. John DeLancey, move over. The thing is, though, the reason that he has this power, obviously, is because the Psi-Corps has been manipulating him with different drugs, with serotonin. And I notice while he pronounces the word serotonin, serotonin.
Yeah.
Do you notice that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if he looked at that script and truly didn't recognize the word serotonin.
See, I don't know that. I look at the signage and the placards that are located throughout the station, throughout the sets, and they've changed spelling of words. And there are certain things like Marilyn Monroe is Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps 300 years down the line, pronunciations have changed.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible. I mean,
do you really think they put that much thought into it, or do you just mess the word up?
No, I'm actually thinking about this because I see placards all the time in the background that eliminate characters and words and stuff. And I'm just thinking, look back to the 60s. Where the Klingons were Klingons, and where a computer was computer. Pronunciation changes.
Okay.
And that's just over the last couple of years. This is the A plot. There's a B plot, but we'll get to that in a minute. With this A plot, the Psi-Corps is experimenting on their own, but who else are they experimenting on? We know that they have no problem whatsoever taking someone of their own and going, okay, we're going to make you into something better, mm-hmm. into something bigger. And they would literally kill to be able to have this power.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't be allowed to. But if they can do it once, what else can they do?
Yeah.
And if they're experimenting on this, what else are they experimenting on?
Exactly.
Where are those non-sentient pets coming from?
You know, I think telepaths are just the root of all evil.
That's right.
No, telepaths aren't Psi-Corps.
Yeah, there's other telepaths. I mean, we look at the Minbari telepaths, and they're not like that at all. Okay, let's go move on to the B plot. The B plot is Catherine is sent to Sigma 957 to do a survey, and it's in a contested area of space. Jakar is representing the Narn, because the Narn are contesting that. And he's trying to tell her, look, Sigma 957 is not a healthy place. Don't go there. Strange things are happening there. And she thinks that it's just because he's trying to get at Sinclair. And it makes sense from her perspective and from the audience's perspective.
You know, that's true. But I will say that I noticed instantly, first time I saw this episode, that Jakar's tone was sincere and conciliatory.
You know, but does she know that?
No, she doesn't. But I mean, I noticed it in the way that the part was performed. It was not, I'm going to spite you. I'm going to do everything in my diplomatic power to prevent you from doing anything with this planet. This is in our jurisdiction. You can't have it. No, his tone wasn't like that. His tone was, listen, I'm telling you the truth. This is a dangerous place. There's things that go on out there. There's things that go on in that realm of – in that sector of space that are strange. We have no explanation for them. People go there and don't ever come back. I'm warning you for your own sake. Don't go to that planet.
And from what she knows of him, she ignores it completely.
Yeah, because she thinks he's just being spiteful and difficult for the sake of being spiteful and difficult. And for once, he's not. And that adds dimension to Jakar's character.
It does.
And I like that.
He sends a couple of ships that are Frazi class freighters that are well armed,
and that kind of conveys the message to the audience that he is sending warships out there to intercept her archaeological vessel and destroy it. Mm-hmm. That's what's implied.
Oh yeah,
But as it turns out, no.
No, what he's doing...
He saved her ass.
Oh, big time. Because she goes out there and she's getting ready to do this survey and she's just having fun on her ship, the Sky Dancer. Mm-hmm. And starts the survey and is stepped on.
Yeah.
By one of the first ones. Not counting Kosh, this is the first time on the series that we've seen one of the first ones.
Right, and at this point it hasn't even been revealed that the Vorlons are that old.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, she's just out there, and all of a sudden this gigantic ship just flies out of hyperspace. And when it comes out of hyperspace, the jump point is so powerful, and just the proximity of this huge ship drains all power out of her tiny little archaeological vessel. It glances at her, barely takes notice of her, and then just flies back into hyperspace and is gone.
You know it's not an archaeological vessel. It's a survey vessel. They're different.
Okay, fine. It's her survey vessel then.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're excused.
So then this giant mysterious ship that's just appeared out of nowhere, drained all the power to Sakai's ship, is just gone. And now she's in a decaying orbit. She does not have any power to activate her thrusters and pull herself out of the gravity well of this planet. And she's just slowly falling towards the surface of this planet. And she's pretty much screwed.
Oh, big time. And just in the nick of time, here come the two Narn ships. They grab her and say, we're here to escort you back to Babylon 5 on Jakar Third Circle's orders. Mm-hmm. And that's what she does. So she has a great scene with him at the end of the episode.
That little exchange between the two of them is one of those things gets your imagination going. I was still just a kid when I saw that, and I remember, wow. Wow, they really know how to capture the imagination, don't they? They're really well done. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite parts about that is no one hears exactly who they appeared. Not me, not Mallari, not Sinclair, not even you. No one hears what they seem. And if I've surprised you, so much the better. Yeah. And I love that.
Yeah.
And he's asking about this ant. This thing that's on a plant, and she says, well, they're ants, that it's hard to keep them out in the transports from Earth. And he says, if I pick this up and then put it back down, what will one ant say to another? How would they be able to convey what that is, who Jakar is or who any of this is?
Yeah. So you pick an ant up on my finger, and now I'm going to put it back down. And then it's going to run up to another ant and point up at me and say, what the hell was that? How is it going to explain? And then he goes on to draw the same parallel between
her and the first one.
And the aliens that almost killed her. The aliens are so advanced and so old that to them, we're nothing more than ants. And that's really, really well portrayed.
They can either be stepped on or get out of the way. And they've learned this. And he specifically says, because we've tried.
Yeah.
So they've been out there looking for these first ones, and it may have connection with their lost telepathy, telepaths, or it may be something else. We don't know, but we know that they've looked for them. Was this way back 1,000 years ago? Was this after the Centauri were driven from their home world? We don't know. But we know that they've looked for them, and they've learned, get the hell out of the way. Otherwise, you're going to be toast.
Yeah, and... You can't really fight the first ones.
No, and I've got another favorite line from this episode. Taken out of context, it means something completely different. Jeff is trying to warn Catherine not to go out there, but she's saying, Jeff, I've been around the block a few times.
All right. So are we going to come back to the A plot? Because that B plot is so separate from this other storyline that's going on in the same episode that, you know, we were sitting here talking about the first ones and Sigma 957 and Catherine Sakai. Oh, yeah. It's called Mind War. There's Besters in this episode. So, yeah.
Yeah, Besters in this episode. Bester is played by Walter Koenig, who was in some star show. What was it called?
Oh, Star Trek? Is that it?
That's it, yeah. Star Trek.
Yeah, from the original series, Star Trek, he was Chekhov.
Yes, he was the guy with the bad Russian accent and horrible wig.
Yeah. I wonder if it's the same wig.
No. I'm going to say this, another difference about Joe's writing. We know more about Bester after his 42 minutes of this episode than we learned in 35-plus years of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
We know about Chekhov Nothing. All we know is he thinks Russians did everything, invented everything, whatever. We know more about Bester. It's just – it's brilliant. He's not using some weird accent. He's acting.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, he's good.
Oh, yeah.
Walter Koenig.
Koenig.
Thank you. Walter Koenig is a brilliant actor, and his portrayal of Bester – Bester just seems like there's something missing from him, doesn't it? There's just a hole where his conscience should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's almost like the absence of life. He's like this big black hole that just walks on the scene and just all light and happiness just seems sucked out of the room. This the way he portrays this character, he is just a perfect villain. Perfect.
I can't help but think you're talking about the bad guys from Harry Potter. The guards from Azkaban, they drain all the happiness away.
I got nothing. Anyway, back to Babylon 5. So we've got the pursuit. You know, they're trying to catch this Ironheart guy. They're being dishonest with the command staff of Babylon 5. And, you know, Jason Ironheart's there. Now he's sequestered himself into quarters down in somewhere in Babylon 5's down below in Brown Sector, which is kind of like the bad part of town for Babylon 5. And so all of a sudden his telekinetic abilities just sort of expand to a point beyond what he can control, and he seals himself off with a telepathic force field and just seals off an entire section of the station to keep himself left alone so he doesn't hurt anyone.
But he does Kazimtek.
Yeah, thanks.
But he does let Talia through.
Yeah.
And eventually lets the commander through. And then here come Bester and Miss Kelsey.
Mm.
The less said about Kelsey, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great episode. Some of the characters, actually, they're pretty much perfect. I mean, this is one of the best episodes of the series. It's got its faults, Miss Kelsey's accent. But overall, it's really good. I do want to point out something. When Ironheart is going to his quarters, he's being shown to these quarters by this woman who is standing there. She's like a guest liaison. Uh-huh. And I have to wonder, she's in space on a space station. Why is she wearing a hat? If you look at a lot of the women in especially the first season when they're walking down the sets and the corridors and being shown in the Zocalo, why are women wearing hats on a space station?
I don't understand why they wouldn't. What do you mean?
Hats.
Yes.
You know, those things people wear on their heads. You see them on Earth, and a lot of people would wear them to keep the wind out. There's no wind on the space station.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not why I wear a hat, but all right.
You wear a hat because you have no hair.
Yeah, I'm going bald, and I like to mask it and make myself look better than I do. You should try it.
Oh, shut up.
All right. Okay. Yeah, we're both failed participants in the Hair Club for Men.
Yeah. Okay, Mind Ward, the cast, we've got William Alan Young, who played Jason. Felicity Waterman played Miss Kelsey. She's really done nothing else of note. Her last credited role was in 1997. Don Dow played an Earth fighter. He was also in Buffy, The West Wing. He was in Bruce Almighty and was one of a handful of people to reprise their roles in Evan Almighty, the sequel to that. Elisa Gabrielli played the guest liaison. She's pretty much a voiceover actress. Her biggest role to date is in the Madagascar films, where she plays the little old lady Nana, who likes to kick the lion's butt. And this was the first appearance of Macaulay Bruton playing Garibaldi's aide. He is the one that shoots Garibaldi in the back later on.
Mm-hmm.
His last credited role was in 2003 in a movie called Politics or Murder. The only other credited role he's had was in a TV movie from 1989 called Fire and Rain.
Okay.
So is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Well, we took down some notes, and there are some pretty cool points in here that I think we should touch on for just sort of fleshing out the telepath culture as it exists within human society, Earth culture. You have written down here, the most telepaths have fewer rights than normals. They're forbidden to possess psi abilities unless they're part of the psi corps or in prison. they're required to submit to scans by psychos. We touched on that, the way that Bester and Kelsey interrogated Talia very, very mercilessly. It's really interesting, you know. This right here touches on the fact that humans, you know, with all of our ability to embrace or at least recognize and embrace differences, we still sometimes choose not to. Telepaths have begun to emerge in this timeline several hundred years from now, and we, you know, the Psych Corps seems like a good idea because a telepath who is unscrupulous and dishonest could cause a lot of trouble. But, you know, the greed takes over and the corruption takes over and the Psi Corps becomes this, like I mentioned, really frightening kind of entity that is starting to pull strings and cause a lot of problems. So it touches on humans' tendency to fear what they can't understand and try to contain it. Mm-hmm. And that's what Psi Corps is. Psi Corps is a way that people who don't have telepathic abilities can feel comfortable with the existence of telepaths. And it, you know, it is a form of persecution and segregation a little bit because there's a severe lack of trust there.
And the telepaths just accept it. Mm-hmm. They just go with it because that's what they're told. That's the law, yeah. As Talia says.
Well, I think we could go on and on about everything because there's a lot of substance to this episode. There really is. And it's one of those that really gets you thinking. You know, I remember when I first watched this episode too, you know, I was starting to really build up a lot of momentum in my enthusiasm for Babylon 5. And it was episodes like this one that just made me while I was waiting to go to sleep, laying in bed, and I just think about all the different possibilities and just think about what if there were actually telepaths. And there's so much substance in this episode. This really helped launch the series, which is still in its infancy at this point. This gave it a lot of momentum and really, really helped prop up the series, episodes like this one.
Yeah, something that you just said reminded me. Of course you were lying in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking about this. That's because it was aired at like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. And now it jumped around from time slot to time slot, but it picked up steam, and it was episodes like this where, you know, the series had already sort of developed a little bit of its own momentum, and it wasn't like Midnight on the Firing Line. I mentioned way back in our Midnight on the Firing Line podcast how it just seemed like they were trying to make everything super dramatic just to get people interested, and that's, you know, that's all kindling and no coals right there, but you know, I guess they had to get it off the ground somehow. This is the actual substance of Babylon 5. This is the creative inspiration. This is the actors, the writers, and the directors all coming together really well. This is them putting their hearts into this. This is quality Babylon 5.
Thank you, Bruce Seth Green.
Yeah. Good director, too.
That's right.
Okay, so I guess that wraps it up for Mind War. Thanks for listening. And once again, we want to hear your feedback. We want to interact with our listeners. Don't be afraid to email us. You can email me at steveonthestation@gmail.com.
Right, or mitchonthestation@gmail.com. You can also leave feedback on the mypodcast.com site, or you can also leave reviews on iTunes.
And We are out. We are out. And real quick, last thing, we are planning to put up a MySpace page for our podcast at some point. We'll have more information to you about that as it becomes necessary. We'll have a blog. We'll have places where you can leave comments, anything you want.
And we plan that sometime before the year 3000.
Yes. All right. This is Steve on the station.
This is Mitch on the station. Good and night. We are out.
Bye-bye.
The station podcast was recorded and produced and edited by Jeff Pham at Infinite Productions in 2009. Very nice. The station.